The Guardian.
On the other side of the world, there is a country called Happyland, where the trees are 100 feet.
Mr. Happy was one of the residents of Happyland, and he was always very, well, happy. Living in Happyland, where even the flowers are happy, how could he be anything but?
He lives in a small cottage beside a lake at the foot of a mountain and close to
Roger Hargreaves' books were adapted by Flix Films for the BBC in 1974. In it, Mr. Happy meets Mr. Miserable. Mr. Miserable looks exactly like Mr. Happy, a yellow blob with arms and legs, except
that he didn't look happy at all. In fact, he looked downright miserable. "Hello, Mr. Happy. How would you like to be happy, like me?" asked Mr. Happy. "I'd give anything to be happy," said Mr. Miserable. "Well, I'm so..."
By staying in Mr. Happy's house in Happyland, Mr. Miserable becomes happy.
And Mr. Happy was so surprised that he started to laugh as well.
A happy ending. But for those of us who don't live in Happyland, it's not quite so simple. The question of how we can be happier is a topic that dominates self-help books and has blossomed into an area of research known as positive psychology. It's striving to apply the scientific method to this emotion, but how much do we really know about happiness? And could this constant pursuit of happiness actually be bad for us? I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
I'm Dr. Dean Minette. I'm currently a research associate honorary for Cardiff Psychology School. I'm full-time author now and regular contributor to The Guardian via my brain-flapping science blog, because it's basically just a massive...
Dean has recently written a book called The Happy Brain. In it, he explores what's going on up there when we're feeling cheery. He came to The Guardian to discuss what he's learnt. I couldn't help but notice he was wearing a yellow T-shirt with a big smiley face. Did that mean he'd unlocked the secret to everlasting happiness? No, but he was feeling happy-ish.
I like this shirt because it's basically just a massive smiley face, the emoticon. But yeah, it's part of the research I found in that the sight of a human face actually does tend to influence our behaviour and our attitudes towards other people. So it's sort of like a very subtle but obviously a desperate attempt to make audiences like me by showing an extra face staring at them the entire time while I'm talking.
Well, let's talk about happiness then. So when it comes to happy, we all know what it feels like to be happy. But is there a way to define that? Is there a scientific way of saying this is what happiness is?
It is an odd one in that happiness is one of those words which everyone relates to. Everyone sort of has a baseline understanding of what it means, or from the subjective point of view that I know what it's like to be happy. But if you ask like a dozen people to define it, you would probably get a dozen different definitions. Like an example I tend to use to explain this to people is that some people are content, some people are relaxed, some people are ecstatic, some people are overjoyed, some people are giddy with happiness, euphoric. These are all ways in which to be happy, but a lot of them don't overlap, don't really combine that well, because you can be ecstatic, you can be relaxed. It's very rare, I'd say nigh on unheard of, to be ecstatically relaxed. You don't really get people who are like sat in an armchair with a whiskey in front of a fireplace going, "Yes, oh my God, this is amazing," because that's not how we work. But both people would be happy. So I'd say, based on the research I've done, is that happiness would be best considered as an umbrella term for all the ways which we can feel positive and rewarded by something we've done or something we've experienced.
And when we want to look at things like happiness in the brain, I guess the first question is, what do we know about how happiness works? And is the fact that it is an umbrella term, as you say, for all these different states, does that make it kind of difficult to unpick what's going on?
It does, actually. It does make it very tricky to look at the brain as, you know, as an organ, as a system of different mechanisms and functions, and to truly say this is what happiness looks like. Because this idea that you can put someone in like a brain scanner and make them experience something, like the example I use is like show them a picture of a carrot and the bit of the brain lights up and you say, oh, that's the carrot center of the brain because that bit lit up, we showed them a carrot, which it isn't ever that simple, that straightforward. And I think it would be nigh on impossible to take a snapshot of the brain any one time and say, this is what happiness looks like. You know, you've seen that on Facebook recently. There's this artist image of, like, I think it's like endorphin or some receptor combining with a protein, which is like dopamine or something like that. And it says, this is what happiness looks like. And it's not. That's just a chemical reaction. The whole way in which the brain does all this is very much more of some of its parts thing. You can't really boil it down to the bare bones like that and say, this is what happiness is. Happiness is a gestalt of all these different processes happening at once. So yes, we have an idea of what's going on in the brain when we're happy, but to pin it down to one specific thing, that's a long way off if it ever happens, because 90% of the time, that isn't how it works. It's far more complex. The analogy
I think of it a bit like a computer. You can't say a computer is the power cable or the memory chip. A computer is a set of hardware. Wires, memory, a processor, and so on. But then there's also the software. All these things make up a computer. Happiness in the brain is also a bit like this. A complex set of neurons and chemicals that combine together to create that feeling. But whilst I think of it a bit like a computer, Dean likes to think of it as a hamburger.
So we see it as like this individual object on a plate, that's a hamburger. So therefore I'll eat that, I'll like that, I'll be happy, hooray. But hamburgers don't just occur, they don't pop out of the void fully formed. They're the result of constant different processes. Like there's the whole raising cattle and grinding up beef and the whole slaughterhouse industry, which is responsible for that part of it. And there's also like the people who grow the cereals and the wheat and things to make the bread, and they have someone else to bake that and send it along to the restaurant in like cars and vans and all across the transit system. And people, someone has to cook it and someone has to prepare it. And someone, you know, even if you don't have any vegetables on it, which is another whole facet of society. So what looks like a very sort of simple object on a plate in front of us, which we can then enjoy, is actually the result of countless complex processes and industries and feeds and things coming together to form this eventual object. And that's sort of how happiness is in the brain. We sort of see it as happiness. That's a thing. I know what that is. But it's produced by so many different inputs and variables and contextually different facets. And as a result, like a hamburger, like anything else, you break it down into its individual components, it becomes more and more complex the closer you look at it.
So, Dean, how many things are involved in happiness in the brain?
Arguably, every part of the brain is involved in happiness to some extent. Like if you see something that makes you happy, then the visual cortex is involved. If you hear a song that makes you happy, then the auditory cortex is involved. If you do something which makes you happy, then the emotional systems are involved. And there's also like the frontal parts of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, which involves a lot of higher function, which does arguably, or often enough, sort of suppress or inhibit the more animalistic, fundamental parts of the brain, like the impulsive part. The threat detection parts of the brain, anything which quiets those down and makes them act less active, that tends to make us feel more content, more relaxed, less stressed.
It's not only regions of the brain that Dean talked about, but the brain as a whole. And that includes chemicals we often hear about associated with happiness. Dopamine is one, but there's also serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins. Dopamine is released in response to a reward or a pleasant surprise, like finding £20 in your pocket. Certain antidepressants work by increasing the levels of serotonin. Oxytocin is called by some the cuddle chemical. And endorphins are released while, say, running a marathon, and are often called nature's opiates. But these chemicals are not just associated with happiness. They have a range of functions and are involved in a number of processes, from pain relief to social bonding. And it's not a cut and dry equation either. If you increase this chemical, you'll be happy. After all, antidepressants can take weeks before their positive effects are felt.
Yeah, the chemicals throughout the brain, everything the brain does involves these chemicals at the fundamental level. There's so much going on there. Like the brain uses these chemicals in so many different ways. That's sort of how I put across the idea that there are happiness chemicals. It is a misleading and oversimplified view of how the brain uses chemicals like neurotransmitters. The argument, the example I use is it's like Like, the word love is four letters, two of which are O and E, and therefore, by that logic, O and E are the romantic vowels, because they are make up half the word love. That's not how it works, is it? Like, O and E aren't intrinsically romantic. Therefore, like, logically then, if you had a chatter blind which used the words O and E a lot, that would be a very effective chatter blind. So if you go to a girl and say, "Hello, it's me," that would not be stimulating. That would be terrifying. That would sort of be full-on call the police level. So that's not how it works. It is, to say it's, these are the happiness chemicals is a huge oversimplification to the point where it becomes sort of meaningless.
So we've talked a bit about what's happening in the brain, but you also talk in the book about what's happening in our gut. How big an influence is that on our state of happiness, and what's going on anyway?
It's a tricky one. The gut-brain axis is sort of come up relatively recently. It also makes perfect sense. I think a lot of stuff I write does seem to lean towards treating the brain as an individual thing, which is like separate from the body. The body exists around it, but the brain is this little self-contained bubble of processes. And it's not, of course. It's a biological organ. It depends on the body for survival, just as the body depends on the brain for survival. So there's a far greater degree of overlap than what is narratively convenient. And therefore, all other organs interact with the brain. So let's say if you have an ache in foot, for example. If you hurt your foot and you walk around all day with an ache in foot, you'll be in a bad mood because that's unpleasant. It's uncomfortable, makes you feel irritable. It affects your mood. So that's just one very small example of how the body can affect the brain. When it comes to the gut, it's actually even more in-depth and intricate and overlapping. The brain's also is an organ. It depends on metabolites and resources for the rest of the body in order to do what it does. And all those come from, except for oxygen, of course, come from the lungs, all those come from the gut, the digestive system. And not even just like the food you eat, but the bacteria in your stomach can influence what gets metabolized, in what way, to what extent, to what degree. So there is a direct overlap between like the gut and the brain, but it's very hard to establish a direct relationship. So it's hard to say if I eat this particular berry or nut, that'll make me happier because it'll go in my stomach and it'll produce this metabolite which will boost this neurotransmitter level which makes me happy. It's not really that direct. It has to go through the whole body to get there, and that's like 23 degrees of separation.
I think what we can draw from this is that happiness is not something we can point to and say, aha, this is what happiness is. And neuroscience is not likely to be able to do that anytime soon. Happiness is just so complex, there are so many different components to consider. But one thing I've been wondering is the pursuit of happiness a healthy endeavour? Could living in happy land actually make you miserable?
I would say definitely yes. I it's one of the things I really wanted to get across with the book. A lot of people seem to be in the mindset that we should expect that, or we should demand that. We should be happy all the time. And if we're not, then there's something wrong. I think that's unhealthy.
After the break, we'll be asking whether there is a dark side to happiness. I'll be back in a moment after this.
My name is Sigrun. I live in Reykjavik, Iceland. I read The Guardian every morning. I realized that this is something that I would like to pay for. It's a service I value. It's journalism I respect. The Guardian brings me the quality I like. So I realized, hey, this is something I should be a part of.
Hello, my name is Brian and I live in Norwich. I decided to become a supporter of The Guardian newspaper because I like the quality of its journalism. And I also felt it was time to make a stand, because I'm getting tired of the journalism I'm seeing in other newspapers that are owned by rich owners, where there is a lot of bias into their editorials. I hope this inspires some of you to become supporters too, and in your own small way, make a stand.
Hi, my name is Wesley. I live in Utrecht in the Netherlands, and I recently decided to become a Guardian supporter because it's one of the few news sources that I feel is still delivering accurate news. Yeah, it feels like I can trust The Guardian. For me, that's, I think, the most important thing. And especially when they said we don't want to do too much advertisements and we don't want to become dependent upon other people that can manipulate the news, I felt that it was good to support our democracy.
If, like Sigrun, Wesley and Brian, you would like to join the growing number of readers who support our independent journalism, then go to gu.com/support/podcast.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we looked at happiness. What is it? What's going on in our brains when we feel this emotion? Dean described it as being like a hamburger, a complex series of processes and inputs that we're yet to fully understand as a whole. Yet we all have some sense of what happiness is, and often we strive towards it in some sort of hedonistic pursuit. Could that be bad for us? Could it actually make us unhappy in the long run?
Hello.
Hi, this is June.
Hi, June. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. This is Greya, the...
Meet June Gruber, and also our producer, Greya. June is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Greya was keen to explore the role of happiness and its importance.
So we have all kinds of emotional states as human beings, right? They're the things that make us human, they give meaning to our life, but importantly, states like happiness serve important survival functions for us. So the thought of happiness is that it's a positive, pleasantly valent state that orients us towards opportunities, rewards, and good things in the environment around us.
So is it really that surprising that by extension, we want more happiness?
Absolutely not. I think this fascination with happiness dates back many centuries. We see early philosophers like Aristotle, who underscored that happiness, and in his words, is sort of the meaning and end of human existence. And to this date, it's not surprising that we continue to be interested in it and absorbed, because there are many exciting, emerging, scientists would say, robust findings that point to a lot of key benefits of positive states for our psychological and even physical health. We know that it promotes creative thinking, enables us to, as we said, pursue and attain goals, even builds physical immunity to stressors.
So when we see these articles that say, do these five things and you'll be happier, do you think those articles, those books, they have a leg to stand on? Is there a definitive equation, if you like, that says, do this and you will be happy?
Well, I think the answer isn't quite that simple. I think there's no definitive equation for what's going to make us happy. And I'm not sure that we'll ever get there or that we necessarily ever want to get there. It's dangerous to try to put a particular single equation on what is happiness, because I think there's a lot of variation from person to person. And the research shows that if we try too much to focus on formulating that equation and pursuing that equation, that pursuit of happiness in and of itself, if we try too hard, may actually backfire and set us up to be less happy and even at increased risk for symptoms of depression and other mood disorders.
But why? Why would that be the case?
What we're inadvertently potentially doing is setting up expectations, right? Expectations that we're trying to attain. And what we know about the human mind is often when we set up expectations, we may lead ourselves to disappointment if we don't meet that expectation. So some of the work that's come out of this happiness valuation literature has found that the more people endorse items, so wanting to be happy, putting a lot of energy into being happy, emphasizing happiness as a key goal in and of itself, paradoxically, they end up reporting lower levels of happiness when they're experiencing positive things. They also tend to be at greater risk for vulnerability, for depression. And the reason is that if we put happiness as the end goal in and of itself, we may be focusing on the wrong things. sort of putting our spotlight on being happy at all costs, rather than focusing on instead making life choices and engaging in conversations with people and pursuing activities that are meaningful to us in and of themselves. So it suggests that maybe to be happy, it's not about obsessively looking at happiness and just trying to grab it or find it, but instead focusing on interactions with other people, recalling things we're grateful for, that doing things that are meaningful will have happiness follow as a consequence rather than the initial and ultimate goal in and of itself.
And by extension, by not pursuing happiness, you also invite a whole wealth of other emotions, both positive and negative. June's work has shown that having emotional diversity is key to maintaining well-being and physical health.
So some of the work that my colleagues and I have done have looked at this concept of emotional diversity. So we know that biodiversity, for example, in a physical environment, creates a more healthy ecosystem the more biodiversity we have. We applied this construct to the human mind and asked the question, well, might a more diverse internal kind of human emotion ecosystem, in other words, if we experience a more diverse range of emotions, not just positive ones, but also sadness, occasional fear, and other kinds of positive emotions like love, compassion, gratitude, might that actually be a more reliable predictor of overall sort of well-being and health? And so we looked at this in several studies, large cross-sectional studies of adults, and found that the more diverse emotional experiences people reported on a daily basis, that actually predicted greater physical health and even improved psychological well-being. So I think this suggests that maybe what happiness or well-being is about is experiencing a full, rich, and diverse range of emotions. Because every emotion, not just happiness, is telling us something about the environment around us. Even emotions like embarrassment, as painful as they may feel in the moment, they actually signal to other people that we value social norms, and others report liking us more, forgiving us more, and trusting us more when we display embarrassment. So I think the point here is that every single emotion we have is there for a reason. It has a critical function. And so it's not surprising that we would see people who experience a wider variety of emotions, even negative ones, might fare better off when it comes to overall well-being and health.
That said, why do you think there is this huge emphasis on being happy? You know, I scroll through my Instagram feed and I see pictures of people's perfect lives, the same on Facebook and Twitter and the like. So if it's healthier, if it means we have more friends, if we experience a range of emotions, we're sort of happier and healthier in the long run, why is there this huge emphasis to be happy?
I think for some reason it makes sense, because we know that positive emotions do have these uncovered important benefits, as we spoke about at the beginning of our discussion. But I'll tell you, at the same time, I think a lot of this is very culturally influenced. So in Western European countries, we know that, and this is work by Jeannie Tsai, a psychologist at Stanford, that there's a big premium placed on the kind of happy emotions you might be imagining. So we call these high arousal positive states, like joy and excitement. And this may be highly influenced by some of our kind of cultural mindsets. So we're a very individualistic country. We value a lot of individual achievement and pursuit of goals. So in some ways, it's not surprising that we might see individualistic societies with a sort of high premium placed on positive emotions that are, you know, the kind of happy, joy, excitement. But I'll tell you that really interesting cross-cultural research from more collectivistic societies, so there's been some research done in China, among other nations, doesn't show the same obsession with happiness that you and I are talking about now. But instead, there's more of a cultural emphasis on what we call these low arousal positive states, serenity, contentment, calm. So I think as we move forward, we're going to be seeing a more balanced portrait of well-being as a function of encouraging all emotions and simply accepting them with a non-judgmental attitude.
So what does it mean in practical terms? Embracing and acknowledging the lows as well as the highs, and taking pleasure in doing things for their own sake, rather than doing them in the pursuit of happiness. June Gruber and Dean Burnett have spent a large portion of their careers researching happiness. What have they learned from this, and how has that changed how they live their lives now?
I mean, I think you can't help but use the science to reflect and inform your own daily life. And that's not to say that, you know, happiness researchers are, you know, perfectly happy by any means, but I think we try to use the science to become more aware. And I think one of the most critical distinctions that I think about in my daily life is teasing apart what are my emotional goals and what am I, or my actual current emotion states, and trying to think about those separately, but in a way that is not so goal-driven. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I certainly face, and that we're trying to find new innovative psychotherapies to target. What are ways that we can not just try to change what people feel, but actually change the attitudes that they cultivate towards their emotions to be more accepting and less judgmental and less critical?
And what about Dean? Did he learn anything about his own happiness while writing his book?
It was like eye-opening in many ways, in terms of, like, I knew that we're a social species. I knew that social interactions and social approval were a big part of what makes the brain tick. I didn't quite appreciate the extent of that, though, in that it seems like I never really thought of it before, but we have emotions which only work in the context of what other people think of us. Like we have emotions like embarrassment and guilt. These aren't things which make any sense if we're alone. If we're like trapped on a desert island, you won't ever feel embarrassed because there's no one around, no one to judge you, unless you've got a volleyball with a face on it, like the film. And that's an exception to the rule. These emotions only make sense, only work in the context of other people. And same with happiness. Like we can be happy on our own, but the analogy I use is like we can get everywhere by hopping on one leg. We can do that, but it's not necessarily the best way of doing it. It's inefficient. It's not what we're meant to do. There are better ways of doing it. So if you incorporate other people into your happiness a lot more, then that's a lot more helpful. It's a lot easier to do it that way.
Spending time with people is what Dean seems to be saying. And on that note, I'll be off to a barbecue with friends. All that's left to do is to thank June Gruber and Dean Burnett for joining us on Science Weekly. If you'd like to read Dean's book, The Happy Brain, you can find links on our website, guardian.com/podcasts. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.